My name is Marissa Renardi. I am Associate Director of Quantitative Systems Pharmacology at GSK.
And I'm Parmvi Bahia, a neuroscientist communicator, a giant nerd, and the host of Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology. Thank you so much for joining, Marissa. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. And just for clarity, I'm also a giant nerd.
Good to know. I love to start off this podcast by challenging people's allegiances. So with this, being a podcast about mathematical biology, if you had to root for someone, would it be Team Math or Team Bio?
So I'm going to give a bit of a non-answer. So I'm a mathematician by training, and I come from a very math-heavy family, but I rely very heavily on collaboration with trained biologists and clinicians. So I very much see math and bio not as separate teams, but as playing different positions on the same team.
Ah, I think I've heard various versions of this, but I like the idea of them being on the same team. So my next question is also designed to put you on the spot. As scientists are notorious for not being very succinct about sharing our work. So can you describe your research in 60 seconds or less?
Yeah, so I develop models of disease and targeted therapeutics through collaborations with biologists and clinicians, and use simulations and analyses to accelerate and de-risk drug development.
That was very speedy. I like that.
I've sometimes been accused of being too terse, so.
Oh, I see. Well, any science communicator would be very proud of the job you've just done. So as with 99% of our guests, you're a member of SMB. Can you tell us what the society means for you as someone working in the field?
Yeah, so I think SMB was sort of where I built the foundation of my professional network as a graduate student and postdoc. So to me, SMB feels a bit like home. But now that I've moved to industry, SMB is sort of a way for me to stay connected with the academic math bio community and stay informed about the advancements that are being made there.
Very cool. That's another thing we hear a lot, is that it feels like home to a lot of people, which I'm sure is very reassuring to them. So you're not just a member, but also the chair of the newly formed pharmacometrics subgroup. And in season one of the podcast, we spoke with Mike Watson about what creating a subgroup involves. Now, since yours is not as self-explanatory as cardiovascular modeling, can you begin by explaining what pharmacometrics means?
Yeah, so pharmacometrics is basically all of the quantitative modeling that goes into drug development. So this includes things like pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic modeling, or PK/PD, physiologically based pharmacokinetics, or PBPK. We like acronyms in this field. Exposure response modeling, disease progression modeling, and then what I do is quantitative systems pharmacology. So it sort of encompasses all these different types of quantitative models that go into informing decision-making and drug development.
Yeah. So as we learned from Mike, this is no small lift and it's a volunteer position. There's a lot of work that you have to put into it. So why do you think this was important to establish?
Yeah. So I think that pharmacometrics is really a growing field. And, you know, especially I'm coming from quantitative systems pharmacology, which has been growing pretty rapidly over the last decade or so. So there's really significant demand for good modelers in the biopharma industry, as well as demand for academic collaborations that can help drive drug R&D. But academic and industry modelers often don't get a lot of opportunity to commingle, which means that, you know, for example, academic advisors may not be able to advise their students on industry career paths very well because they may not be aware of, you know, the opportunities that are there. And industry modelers may lag behind a bit on the methodological advancements that are coming from academia. So I think this subgroup, for me, is really a tool to get the two communities more integrated and talking to each other, so that we can share sort of important applications, methodological advancements, career advice and experience, and, you know, mentoring of junior scientists and things like that. So we hope that this will really strengthen the bonds between academic and industry modelers for the betterment of the field.
Very cool. So it's more than just the field itself. It's an opportunity for people to learn more about industry too.
Yeah.
Nice. So I had a little poke about on the subgroup webpage on SMB's site. And so at some point we spoke with Reinhard Lautenbacher, who mentioned digital twins in our conversation. And if I recall correctly, we also spoke with Matt Penn about virtual populations. So one of the cool things I saw on that page talks about in silico trials. Can you tell us more about what that means?
Yeah, so in silico trials can mean different things depending on what stage you're at. So if you're sort of in an early stage and you don't have much clinical data yet, this may mean developing a model based on what you've seen in preclinical studies and sort of physiological ranges for whatever is in your model, whether it be sort of immune cells or inflammatory cytokines or something like that. So you may be doing some sort of parameter sampling to generate what's sometimes called plausible patients. So sort of generating a population that seems like it physiologically could occur, and then simulating what happens when you treat that population with a drug in silico, just meaning in simulation. If you have, you know, individual level clinical data, say you've already run a phase two or phase three clinical trial, then you can construct a population that is more representative of the real clinical population. So you can do that either through digital twins of, you know, individually fitting model parameters to individuals in the population, or you can do this at a more sort of population level of trying to capture the full range of responses in the population. And so in that way, you can run, you know, different versions, say, of your clinical trial. What if we had selected a different subpopulation? What if we had dosed a little bit differently or at a different frequency? And that can help to inform future clinical trials for that therapeutic or for other similar therapeutics in your pipeline.
Very neat. And so how much do you think this would assist or potentially reduce the need for certain aspects of real, like, clinical trials on humans?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've seen figures of like the percentage of drugs that enter clinical trials that end up making it to approval. And it's pretty dismal. It's like less than 10%, depending on the therapeutic area that you're looking at. And so the hope is that with modeling, we can make, you know, better informed decisions as far as weeding out the drugs that are not likely to succeed so that we don't waste time and resources running clinical trials that are going to fail, but also designing our clinical trials in a way that we are most likely to see a statistically significant benefit. So I think with modeling, we can, you know, quantitatively predict what the effect size will be looking at a particular biomarker or clinical score, and how that varies by, say, disease stage or some other feature of the population, and use that information to design a trial so that you have enough of an effect and enough of a sample size to see the benefit. Because I think there are a lot of drugs that, you know, see a non-statistically significant benefit and it's not enough. But maybe if the trial were designed a little differently, it would have succeeded.
Yeah, that's so important. So many scientists live around those kind of what we refer to as p-values, the things that say this effect is a real effect. So yeah, it's true that we end up having to throw away a lot of data just because we see a consistent increase, but it doesn't fall within those parameters.
Right.
So having spoken about the subgroup at SMB, I wanted to go back to the start of your career to find out what your path was into the field of mathematical biology specifically.
Yeah, so it was not a very direct path. So my parents are mathematicians. They both did fluid dynamics. And so I tried to do anything else other than math and started my undergrad in architecture at Virginia Tech. And after a year or so, I found out that I kind of hated design and architecture and that I was really much better at quantitative fields. And so I had been taking extra math classes and I liked the classes I had taken. So I decided to switch majors to math after my third semester. I think in my third year, I started doing undergraduate research, which ended up turning into a master's thesis in numerical linear algebra. And I went on to the PhD program at Ohio State, thinking my interest was in numerical analysis and numerical methods. So I chose my advisor, which was Dr. Qingxian Cho, because she was in the field of numerical methods for PDEs, which I found really interesting. And she happened to also be working in mathematical cell biology. I had talked to her about sort of what I wanted to do after grad school, and I wasn't sure at that time if I wanted to pursue an academic career or industry or national labs or something like that. So she recommended that I work on a math bio project because it would be sort of more marketable for a non-academic path. And then once I started working in that area and sort of understanding the biological applications of math modeling, I found out that I was actually much more motivated by the applications than I was by the mathematical methods. So I was sort of hooked from then on.
Did your parents feel at all betrayed?
Not at all. I think they were pleased that I was at least in a more applied field than what they were doing.
So what's very cool today is that you're our first guest with an industry position. Now, I have fond memories of GlaxoSmithKline, or GSK, as it's more popularly known, or at least I have fond memories of the size of their lab budget. Because my PhD when I was at University College was partly funded by them. And so that meant I got to go there and work. And for some of my experiments, I got to take advantage of their incredibly well-equipped core facilities to do some of my experiments. Mm-hmm. I also got to see what it was like working for a pharma company. So as someone who's also transitioned from that university environment to a company like GSK, can you tell us what the main differences are, at least in your opinion, between industry and academia?
Yeah, I think for me, the main difference is the motivation of the problems that I work on. So in academics, I worked on problems because they were interesting and novel. But in industry, I work on problems because they are valuable. So that doesn't mean that they're not interesting or novel, but the way in which I choose which problems to work on is a bit different, and the ways in which I ask for funding or resources are different because I need to put everything in the context of business value. So everything has to have sort of a return on investment. For example, like spending, you know, years developing some new method for parameter estimation where there's a questionable return on investment, it's not going to be worth it for my company. But, you know, adapting a published model to make predictions about one of our drugs could be very valuable, which, you know, maybe in academics may be seen as not very interesting or an incremental advancement. So yeah, I think the biggest difference for me is sort of how I motivate my work and how I think about which problems are worth pursuing.
Yeah. So one of the things about pharma companies is they are often vilified by a lot of people as a result of some of their activities, and sometimes potentially is justified. But I also know what an important role that they play in driving research that's so important to developing new technologies and treatments to improve our health. So do you ever find people react negatively to where you work? And if so, how do you deal with it?
So first, I want to say that any opinions I express are my own and not the opinions of my employer. I haven't gotten a lot, honestly, of negative reactions about working in pharma, at least not within the scientific community. I think, especially within math bio, I think there's sort of a recognition that, you know, this is a valid career path for modelers. But it is something that I had to reckon with a bit myself when I made the transition to industry. I think there are, you know, certain ethical dilemmas that I have with the way that the pharma system works, especially, you know, in the US. But the value of modeling is sort of like, you know, would I rather pharma be making decisions about clinical trials based on intuition or based on quantitative modeling? I would rather them be considering quantitative modeling and decision making. And the financial aspects of the pharmaceutical and healthcare system in the United States, those things are beyond my control.
Absolutely. Yes. You make a very valid point. They hold the purse strings, and it's an important way to get work done efficiently and quickly, I think. So we seem to have kind of got towards the end of your career before we discussed the beginning of it. How did you end up in your current position and what drew you to it?
Yeah, so after my postdoc, I decided I wanted to go into industry. I started to feel like I was just doing research to write papers, to add lines to my CV, and I wanted to be closer to decision-making, to have more of a direct impact. So I moved first to a company called Applied Biomath, which is more similar to a consulting company. And there I did sort of mechanistic or semi-mechanistic modeling to support a wide range of applications, different therapeutic areas, different treatment modalities. And so that was a really good opportunity for me to get exposed to many different aspects of quantitative systems pharmacology pretty quickly. But it started to feel limiting because being sort of on the outside as a consultant coming in and helping, I didn't get to see the full context for the projects that I was working on. So I didn't get to see necessarily what motivated the project, how it was used in decision making, you know, what other functions were also coordinating with the modeling groups to drive decision making and how they were working together. So I really wanted to get more of a holistic view of drug development and what goes into running and planning a clinical trial. So I decided after a few years to make the jump to big pharma. So I joined GSK last year in July. And I chose GSK because in the interview process, I met several people who'd been here for 20 plus years and were happy with their jobs and the company culture. And I think that was really important to me to see people sticking around. And I think the group that I joined sort of shared my philosophy for modeling, which is that a model should be complex enough to answer the question at hand, but not so complex that it can't be reasonably constrained by data. So it was important for me to be joining a group that had the same sort of approach to modeling as I have, and also that has, you know, a welcoming culture, incentivizes collaboration over competition, you know, a good sense of community, and things like that. Those things were really important to me in choosing a company. So that brought me here.
Wonderful. All sound like very solid reasons for taking on a position. Now that we've covered all of this, can you tell us more about your current work?
I can tell you a bit. I unfortunately can't share a lot of specifics about what I'm currently working on. But yeah, sort of in general terms, I do mechanistic modeling to support clinical development at GSK. And I generally support our respiratory, inflammatory, and immune disease portfolio. So I work on things like chronic respiratory disease, autoimmune diseases, and some neurodegenerative diseases. So a lot of the work that I do is in collaboration with external, what we call contract research organizations or CROs, because they often have sort of previous experience in the disease areas that we can leverage to work faster and develop models faster. But I also do some internal modeling, which includes a lot of literature search and discussions with biologists to align on model structure and parameterization, calibrating to published or internal clinical data, and question-driven sort of simulations and analyses. So the typical life of a modeler, I suppose. But I think I spend a lot of time discussing with people from other functions, like biology or biomarkers, omics colleagues, to align on sort of a modeling strategy that fits with the greater strategy of the company so that, you know, we're not working in silos and we're sort of contributing parts to a greater whole to make sure that our strategies are aligned.
Okay. So when you mention functions, you're talking about essentially different departments within GSK?
Yeah. So we have departments on biostatistics, human genetics and genomics, biologists that are gathering data from assays, other functions like that contribute to the data generation, other types of modeling, as well as our QSP colleagues on the preclinical side of things. So there are multiple departments that sort of work together as part of a greater strategy.
Cool. So on the basis of the kind of the disease states you were talking about, it sounds very broad. So you're talking about anything from things like asthma, maybe, all the way through to Alzheimer's. Can you tell us more about the kind of models that you use to study those things?
Yeah, so I think the philosophy in our group is that the models should all be fit for purpose. And so the level of complexity should be driven by the question that we're trying to answer. That said, a lot of these diseases are very complex diseases of the immune system. And so there's, you know, many cell types, cytokines, chemokines to think about, and how these things all interact with each other. It can become really complex rather quickly. So it's a bit of a balancing act, I think. I mean, I would say, you know, generally, we would like for our models to be on the order of tens of states rather than hundreds or thousands of states. But certainly there are models in the field that are that large. And I think they have their applications where those types of models are useful. But we, or I, tend more towards more manageable, smaller models that are, you know, maybe 30 states or something of that order of magnitude. We typically use ODEs, or ordinary differential equations. So we assume lots of things are well mixed, even when that's quite a simplifying assumption, like thinking about the brain. I think there are certainly opportunities where things like PDEs or agent-based models can have a good impact and are suited to answer the questions, but we're often limited by timelines and resources, and spatial models tend to be, you know, a longer and more intensive endeavor to develop and properly parameterize. So I think we often live in ODE land, but every now and then we may borrow some learnings from spatial models as well.
We'll take a trip to PDE land.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that the pharmaceutical industry has come a long way from traditional methods of drug development, you know, how they discover and create new chemicals and how they test them. Certainly since I was in the lab in, when was it, like 2004? That's when I was at GSK. So I'd be intrigued to know what you think the future of drug discovery looks like.
I think that the future of drug discovery looks like modeling, quantitative modeling being integrated end to end from the, you know, target identification and very early development all the way through to after approval, managing the life cycle of your drug. So I think QSP has been sort of a growing field and is increasingly used in drug development, but it is still often used in sort of a piecemeal way where it's brought in when the drug is already in the clinic, or maybe just when you're, you know, trying to predict a first in human dose or something. And so I think it's much less common to see a modeling team having sort of input and being integrated in the development strategy from the beginning all the way through the end. So I think that's what I would like to see happen. And ideally that means, you know, less animal experiments, less clinical trials that won't succeed, and, you know, a greater likelihood of drug approval for the drugs that we do take to the clinic.
That would be tremendous. So as someone whose training was in pharmacology, it's been fun to kind of dust off some of the old knowledge and learn about how the field is changing. So thank you so much for the conversation today, Marissa. But before I let you go, I'm going to subject you to my chosen quickfire questions. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. The first one is, what is the best piece of feedback you've ever received?
So I think professionally, one of the best pieces of feedback I received was from a colleague named Mark Presler at Applied Biomath. He's a biologist. And when I first made the jump to industry, I think I, as many of us modelers do, struggled with making slides that clearly communicated modeling results to non-quantitative experts on the other side. And so I think the feedback I got from Mark was to just annotate every slide or plot with what the key message should be for the viewer. Like, if the point of this is where the peak is, put an arrow pointing to the peak or things like that. So don't assume it's obvious and don't depend on being able to explain it verbally, because people will look back on your slides later and you probably will too in a year when you've forgotten what that main point was. So yeah, I think that feedback was really helpful for me in sort of developing my communication skills.
That is an excellent piece of advice. I had something similar actually from my PhD supervisor. So despite the fact that I went from one neuroscience background to another, I went from very physiological to very, very biochemical. And I remember the first presentation I gave to my new department, I literally explained what an action potential was. So I said to people, like, this is where these ions are going in, this is where these ions are going out. And I had someone come to me afterwards and say, thank you so much for doing that, because I'm a neuroscientist, but I've never studied this before. So yes, I approve of that piece of feedback. My second question is, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?
That's a hard question. And I'm going to ask more specifics.
Ooh,
what does it mean that I can't fail? Does it mean that, like, I could do something that I don't have the resources to do, that magically it would work out anyway?
Sure. Okay. I hadn't thought that far ahead, but yes.
I think I would retire, to be honest.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think everything is more fun when you can do everything on your own terms. So yeah, I think I would retire and I would still work in this field, but I would work whenever I felt like it.
So kind of go back to the way science used to be, where it was just like this very curiosity-driven thing that rich people used to do. Mostly rich people.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great. I would love to have been a historically wealthy scientist.
Excellent. And I was going to say, this is my silly one, but the last one seems to have been a good candidate for that. Would you rather have every traffic light turn green or always have the best parking spot?
I think this one is very context dependent. So if I'm running late for something, I would rather have every traffic light turn green. But if the weather is terrible, I would rather have the best parking spot.
Which one's more likely to happen where you are?
Well, I work from home, so I don't commute. Well, I'm usually not running late for anything, so probably the parking spot.
Excellent. I really appreciate your time. Thanks again, Marissa.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
You've been listening to Biology in Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Pamphit Bahia, at Art Science Media. A reminder that if you're doing cool stuff within the field of math biology and you'd like a chance to be featured, email Jane Heffernan at president@smb.org. Make sure that you go ahead and pitch your research project, your involvement with SMB, and why you think you should be featured, and we'll look forward to picking some new stars for the pod. As always, you can learn more about SMB on the website smb.org and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find the links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. Finally, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite platform, and if you like the show, give us some love by reviewing.
Oh, gosh. Losing words here.
Story of my life.
Right. Yeah. I lost whatever word I was looking for there.